Hi there, and welcome to this, the best of episode of an hour or so with Sue Perkins. I'm going to start with some thank yous. First of all, of course, my wonderful guests who gave their time to come and sit with me in a warm cupboard and chat about shit. I'd like to thank all of our sponsors who support this podcast, to Mike and Karen at Audio Boom, to Debbie, Ruth and Charlene at Curtis Brown, and Waiting for Smith, whose music you've heard throughout the series. You can check out his new track, So Much Love, which is available now on Spotify, and you can find him on Instagram. Most of all, I want to thank my wonderful producer, Dan, the Titian love god, who has sat and listened to my burblings for weeks on end. Where the desert feasts. So, is this your first podcast, Mary?
I don't even know what a podcast is. To me, beans come in pods and you take out the beans. I have no idea what... I don't know whether... I presume it's not television because there are no cameras here. But we've got microphones, so I imagine it'll go on a little disc or perhaps it'll come through the radio. I have no idea what it is. I mean, you're... I'm not into this modern technology.
Oh, you are. Come on.
Go on, tell me about it.
So a podcast is basically a radio programme that doesn't go out on the radio. Instead, it goes out on the internet.
Right. Oh, how very trendy.
So people can go online and they can download it and they can take your voice around with them wherever they go.
Well, that's cheerful for them.
Yes, so they can pop their earphones on and the dulcets of Bez will be wafting.
But how do they find it on the internet? Do they have to look for Sue Perkins?
Yes, or Mary Berry, or the name of the podcast, which I haven't decided upon yet. But once I do, my word, they'll be flocking.
All right, and you're going round chatting to your mates and dogs and that goes on a pod. And a podcast, how long does a podcast... How long does it go on for?
Oh, we're here for 10 hours. Did they not tell you?
Well, that's nice. I don't mind at all.
We'll watch the sun go down together. No, when it goes on, it depends. I mean, it can go on for between about... Sometimes they're 20 minutes, sometimes they're an hour.
And so you do your podcast and you give each little podcast a title.
Yes.
And so they say whether they want to see Mary Berry and Sue Perkins or...
Yeah. There'd be a list of people that I'm chatting to, and then they'd go, "Oh, I like Mary Berry. She has the definitive lemon drizzle recipe." And then they would click on it, and then they'd listen to us in your garden, musing about what on earth a podcast is.
Exactly. Okay. Well, very interesting.
You'll see your
podcast. I now know what a podcast is. I shall go straight to my grandchildren and be really, really knowledgeable.
When Bridesmaids popped up, and it was really Judd. You know, I mean, you know, Judd. We knew each other because of Freaks and Geeks, obviously, and. You know, he sought me out because he knew I loved, you know, working with women and having female characters and all that and telling these stories. And so, you know, he called me and had me come to a table read of that. But it was like 3 years before it actually got made. And I was just finishing up on the company in Miners. It was yet to bomb. And went to this table read, and here was all these great women at this table. It wasn't even the cast that we had, but Melissa was there. I didn't know Melissa at the time. She was reading a different part.
Oh, was she?
Yeah, yeah. She was just kind of like a utility player at this read. And but I'm just going, oh God, here's a chance. You know, the script needed a ton of work, but like here's a chance to have, you can put all these funny women into a movie.
To get on the ground.
Yeah. But then it just kind of went away. It was like Judd, you know, I was busy with my movie and he wanted me to shepherd the script, but you know, kind of for no money. And I was like, I can't do it now. But we gave notes. I was like, just keep me in mind for it. And then 3 years later, it suddenly popped up out of the blue. And Kristen was nice, and, you know, I went and talked to Kristen, and she was nice enough to want me to do it, too. And, you know, then we did it, and it just changed everything.
And how, I mean, the script presumably have gone through various evolutions. How much further work did you all do on it as a cast and a crew?
We did a lot, because it hadn't changed a ton from the 3 years prior. They had kind of done back and forth and stuff, and some other people had come gotten involved and left. So it was really, you know, Kristen and Annie and myself and Judd, and we had a few other writers who kind of had a room going. And Kristen was off in New York doing Saturday Night Live, but Annie Mumolo was with us. And so we were kind of all working on stuff, and then she would send it back to Kristen, and then they would work on it. And send it. So it was an intense kind of three or four months of just really being hard on the script. you know, but always making sure that it was running through Kristen and Andy's, you know, typewriters. And yeah, so, but, you know, when we went into production, we had a lot of script.
And did you get, I mean, we've talked a lot about the kind of incel disapproval at women, kind of women kind of owning and kind of anchoring movies. But I don't know, you don't see your films quite rightly as sort of female movies. Mm. But did you, as you were making Bridesmaids, think that this was going to slightly reinvent the wheel? Did you have that sense, or was it just another day at the office?
It was weird. It was, to us, we just want to make a funny movie, and I was just excited because I could hire all these really funny women. And I definitely had not been happy with the way women have been portrayed, especially in comedy, for years and years and years. You know, they were just always, you know, either just, you know, a foil, or a, you know, the person getting in the way of the funny guy, or
warm props.
Yeah, exactly. Like the shrewish girlfriend or whatever, you know. And so that was exciting to me. But then, yeah, it was just like, let's just make a funny movie that we can all relate to. But then it was more that the town started talking, because a lot of female writer friends who were so inspired that we were doing this, that they kind of saw, oh, good, there's going to be, we can make more female-led movies, because it was really hard to get a female-led movie made. It, you know, it's gotten better, but it's still not the first, you know, it's not the default setting of Hollywood still. Mm. And so they would tell me, like, they'd go out and pitch a movie, and the executives would say, well, okay, well, we got to wait and see how Bridesmaids does. So then it was like, oh, my God.
The pressure of that.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. Also, that just shows how stupid the town is, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, because not like, you know, when they're making The Hangover, it's like, oh, well, don't pitch movies with three guys in it. Yeah. Because if that
no more buddy movies, guys. We need to see how The Hangover works.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because then we can't make movies with guys in it anymore. So yeah, it's ridiculous. But, yeah, but you definitely start to feel that pressure. You know, but we put it together the way we'd normally do a movie and just tested it and, you know, worked really hard on it. But then it was when we were going to open, that was when it was scary, because then I was told through Judd, had heard through the studio had said this to Judd, that, like, if the movie didn't make $20 million or more on the opening weekend, it was going to be considered a failure. Which, and I was just like,
that's the spirit, guys.
I know. And so it's like, oh, God. But I don't know. You know, you make a movie, go like, well, maybe we'll make $100 million. I don't know. You know, but then tracking starts to come in. You know,
what's tracking? What's
tracking is basically where they just, through a series of science that they have through movie theater owners and through polling and just talking to people on the streets, find out, like, if people are aware of a movie, how aware of it they are, what their interest in seeing it is. And so there's all this data that comes down. Like, they have definite, you know, 10% of people have definite interest in this. And it just goes down. So they scientifically can, it's so annoying, because they basically go, they can tell you how much money your movie's going to make through the course of its life.
And are they accurate with their predictions?
They're many times annoyingly accurate. Sometimes they're wrong, but more often than not, so when you get that number, you're like, God damn it, really? Can it be higher than that? Yeah, the simple favor was that. I was like, God, fuck you guys. You know, they're like, it's going to make between $40 and $50 million of theaters. All the theater owners said, like, how dare you? And then they made right around. They made like a little over 50. So, okay. But I remember getting the call that morning, because they had done midnight shows. That's the thing they do now. They do, like, the night before opening night, they'll do these advanced screenings, and they kind of test the water through that. So, but this was a wedding movie. So they did this midnight screening. Nobody knew. So it didn't do that well. So they're like, okay, it's going to make $13 million. So I remember getting this call from my agent. I was sitting on the toilet. I hold nothing back. I remember getting this call on the toilet that morning. He goes, like, it's going to be 13. I was like, oh, fuck, are you kidding me? And he's like, yeah.
In a way, you're in the perfect place.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I was just despondent all day. Just wandering around like, God damn it. And also that feeling of, like, I guess now women don't get to make movies, be in movies anymore.
Yeah, what did you say? You're the one that they're going to hang everything on. It's too much responsibility. So they said $13 million for your opening weekend.
Yeah, 13 in the morning. But then, so, you know, walking around in a haze, and then kind of come mid-afternoon, they're like, well, actually, it looks like it's going to be like $15 million. Like, oh, that's still not good. And then, but then the calls kept coming in, like, every hour. Like, well, actually, they're thinking $17 million now, you know. And then, because these afternoon shows were doing really well. And, then I had Melissa McCarthy and her husband Ben Falcone come to our house because they live in the neighborhood and we're friendly, and said, let's just come over for dinner and we'll kind of, you know, commiserate or see how the night goes. And as we were at dinner at our house, text started coming in, like, it's actually going to be 19, it's going to be 20, it's going to be 21, it's going to be 22, you know, and suddenly it was going to be like 24 million. And we were just like, oh my God. So we like get in the car. So we all got in the car and drove down to the Arclight Theater in Hollywood and walked into this packed theater that was just like rocking. And just every laugh was huge. And we were just like, oh, it was the greatest, turned into like the greatest day of my life.
I mean, obviously, I don't know much about the process of directing a movie, but the fact that you're getting almost real-time updates from Money Men about how your film is projected to be doing is extraordinary.
Oh, it's crazy. But, you know, then the opposite side is, you know, if it's not doing well, the calls suddenly are gone, you know? I mean, that happened with Ghostbusters.
So the guys from People Just Do Nothing, mm-hmm. you've known, do you know them at school? Was
college.
Okay.
So yeah, it was like kind of, it was college, and I was a rap battler at college, so I was known as the rap battler. Well, not known, but I used to rap battle in college.
And were you still Paradox then? Paradox 1.2?
No, I was just Paradoxing. I kind of wasn't the 1080p, hadn't come yet. But and my friend Hugo, who's Beats in the show, and he's a really talented producer and musician, and he's gone on to, you know, win Ivor Novello Awards. People don't know that. He's Keith Chegwin's nephew. Which
what?
Is another weird fact.
Both of these facts have blown my mind.
He's really like, he keeps it all very quiet, but he like produced Emily Sandé's Next to Me. You know that song?
Yes.
He produced that, and it was like, what? So he got into music kind of before the comedy, and he's always been amazing. But,
that's
very low key
about
it.
Works though, because the music works. The music has to work in order for the comedy to.
He's a big part of that, actually. He kind of knows that genre of music so well. And I think there's a, you know, going back to the kind of Spinal Tap thing, it's an art to do something bad good,
yeah,
or bad well, if you know what I mean. Like, you have to know the technical aspects to kind of satirize it, you know. So it's like, and we knew that. So it was like, if you didn't know that, then you can kind of tell straight away that this guy doesn't even know what he's trying to satirize.
Well, then it's just mocking people who want to try and succeed in the music business.
Exactly, yeah.
Who often are working class kids in estates who dream big and...
Exactly. And it's a very... you kind of have to look past all of that. Like, our comedy didn't come from like, oh, look at these, you know, look at this Asian guy talking funny, or look at these chavs trying to, you know, do things. It was like about the characters. Like, let's find the delusion in the characters. So these characters could actually do any kind of music. They could be from anywhere. Chibody G could be any kind of ethnicity. He could be, it doesn't matter. Like, what makes, you know, when you break a character down, like, what makes this character funny? If it's just, oh, he talks in a funny accent, you're gone. You're a 15-second meme.
That's an impression.
Yeah, you're a meme. It's an impression. Exactly. It's not a character. It's not something that people can relate to. It's not like, it's, you know, the great characters I find when you go, oh God, this reminds me of blah, blah. Like, I know someone just like that. And I always think those characters are the ones that stay with us, you know?
And for Chabuddy, what you're doing is and God, I love Chabuddy, but it's, you developed a character that all the paradoxes you describe yourself being well understand. British born, totally. White, kind of middle class people will get your buds.
Yeah.
But first, second generation Asians will get your buds.
That's all their uncles and their brothers, you know, and all their mates. But also, it's kind of just like in any town, that guy who's like, you know, his ability is here, but his kind of delusion and what he thinks he can do, his reach is up here. And there's just loads of comedy in between. The guy who can just, yeah, I can do that. I can do that. I can do that. You know, I can do that. I can get you this. I can get you that. It's insecurity kind of maxed up to, it's kind of blind confidence, but supreme blind confidence. And that's always funny. You know, when someone says something really stupid, but with complete conviction, like, that's funny, you know, like, you know.
He's so convinced that everything's going to slot into place in every moment. There's a calmness to him while everything is going wrong because his sense of self-belief is so concrete.
Yeah. It's the eternal optimist, and like Del Boy is one of the biggest inspirations. You know, like, it's, you know, Del Boy always thought that everything's going to be, you know, this time next year, Rodney will be millionaires. It's that kind of eternal optimism. But if you really study the character, you can see that there are cracks and there's insecurities and vulnerabilities. Yeah. That makes them likable. That when, you know, when he's saying, oh, mate, I can get any chicks. You trust me when I walk down the road. You're looking in his eyes and you're thinking, you haven't had sex for over a decade. You know, you're not getting anything, mate. And you know that. But he's going to tell you, oh, mate, I'm ladies' man. You know what I mean? Like, and that's why I think sometimes, you know, you can verge on creepiness and kind of, you know, being a bit sexist with that stuff, which a lot of those guys are. Like, you know, the real guys are that. But yeah, you know, with a comedy character with the BBC, you can't just outwardly be disgusting and gross. So you need to have that vulnerability. You need to have that kind of delusion.
It's just posturing, isn't it?
It's posturing. It's not like, no one's ever been like, oh God, he's creepy. You know, oh God, he's a threat. He's not
He's sort of physically impotent.
Yes.
But mentally grandiose, isn't he?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Skillshare, the online learning community for the creator in all of us. Getting out of the rut is easier said than done, especially when you have a busy schedule. Whether you want to learn a new skill or get back into an old passion, Skillshare can help build fuel and expand that creative fire. Listeners of this podcast can now get 2 months free when you sign up at skillshare.com/hour. By the way, that weird licking sound in the background is my dog cleansing her paws. Just to be clear. Skillshare have thousands of classes from graphic design to marketing and loads more. I've just spotted an outdoor photography course, which I really want to get started on. The great thing about the classes is that they're on demand, so you can learn at your own pace and at a time that suits you. Learning new creative skills is a great way to relax from the stress of work and family life and an annoying dog who sat right by you as you're trying to record something. Whatever your creative interest may be, Skillshare will have a class for you. Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare and get 2 months free when you sign up at skillshare.com/hour. That's 2 whole months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free. Get started today by heading to skillshare.com/hour to sign up. That is skillshare.com/hour.
I very rarely feel intimidated, but you have made this genre your own, have you not?
Wow, that is true. That we went from the soft open to the hard compliment.
Hard flattery. I mean, that's sort of the hardest flattery I've done. It was almost brutal.
You couldn't even look me in the eye while you were doing it.
No, I couldn't. I got coy. It came out of not unlike me. It's like, this is going to be some really intense loving.
I love it.
But it's true.
Watch me deal with this flattery. Yes, Sue. I'm you glad you're giving me the respect I deserve, because I am the master of this. Can we swear?
Yeah.
Motherfucking medium.
Yes.
And I more or less created it. It's been set up in my image. All the so-called champions of the genre have come after me and taken from me, maybe a little bit from Joe, and not given us any credit. Mark Maron sat there with fucking Barack Obama, as he keeps reminding us, in his garage.
I'd never heard that. He's never mentioned it.
He wouldn't be anywhere if it wasn't for me and Joe having come along, admittedly after Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant, and exploring the medium back in 2006, I think we started on XFM. But yeah, now, I mean, I've lucked out. I've found a medium that agrees with me. But I certainly did see the potential fairly early on.
But it's perfectly lo-fi.
Exactly.
You're the master of lo-fi. And I mean that, again, as a hard, hard piece of flattery.
Thank you.
And it suits lots of comics in the sense that it's just got an intimate kind of shambolism to it that we gravitate to.
Yeah, man. It's the best for the rambly, meandering conversation. I can't think of another medium that does justice to those rhythms and those pauses and longers. And
also the sort of tangential shit that people lob in.
Exactly.
That you wouldn't get in a formal interview, because formal interviews tend to be very on brand, on message. Have you ever had any guests that sort of have not really got the podcast form, and they've been sort of too sort of primped?
Yep. I don't want to mention names, but yes, they do come along. I was talking to your producer, Dan, earlier on, before you arrived.
He's a bastard.
He's a terrible guy. He's not in the room right now.
No, he's not. Thank God he's not here watching us.
He's got a grotesque accent. I think he's from Belfast. I could barely understand what he was saying. He had to write it down.
He's dressed actually as some people from Belfast are, as Khaleesi, as the mother of dragons from Game of Thrones.
That's right.
Is, yeah, and I have to say, works, doesn't it, for him?
Gotta hold myself back from going. Well, can we pick up that tangent in a second?
Yeah, park it and we'll return.
All right, that's not what. That's one thing I'm really bad at doing.
I've got Khaleesi on the brain, so it's all right. We'll come back to that.
But no, Dan is sat in the room with us, beautiful Belfast, home of Van Morrison and all wonderful things.
So bad guests.
But bad, we were talking about the politics of podcasts and booking guests and trying to create a selection of guests that isn't all just your mates. And, you know, if it's me, most of the people I know are other kind of middle-aged white guys. And so you do, you know, you're trying to look around for people that you don't know very well or that you think are interesting, but you haven't met them before. And then you start, once you're on the radar a little bit, you start getting approaches from PR companies and people plugging books or films or TV shows or whatever. And some of those are people that you're interested in and excited to talk to. And they're often dangled in front of you. Do you want to talk to Jordan Peele? Yes, I want to talk to Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
He's great. But, and then it's like, when can I talk to Jordan Peele? And then they say, oh, well, you can talk to him for half an hour on Tuesday. And then you think, oh, I can't do Tuesday. And then...
Did you blow out Jordan Peele because of your schedule?
Yeah.
No.
Because I'm doing the school run on Tuesday and I have to take out the bins. So I can't do Tuesday. Is there any other time I could talk to Jordan Peele? No, he doesn't live in England. He's on a press junket. You've got half an hour, you can fuck off. So I had to fuck off.
Is it true, by the way, that when you were researching Veep, you got to, I don't think it was the White House, but you just breezed in somewhere saying that you were there for a 12:30 appointment.
Yeah, yeah, it was the State Department.
And you just, I mean, it's unthinkable now with the level of security
it
and vigilance.
No, this would be, it was, when was it? So it was about 2009. So, yes, it was post 9/11.
Yeah.
Somebody said, a journalist from a Washington paper said, oh, just show them your BBC pass and say you're here for the 12:30. And my BBC pass is probably the same now at the BBC. It was just my face. It was just a photo with the words BBC, you know, that a child could have pressed
with
F1.
A hint of lamination,
you know,
but not,
just,
yeah.
That's it. That and on a lanyard.
Yeah, that's enough.
A lanyard. Honestly, ISIS. And also, to be for balance, those against ISIS. If you want to enter buildings, a lanyard is your secret weapon.
It's true.
Yeah. So I kind of went up and said, I'm Andy Uche, BBC, I'm here for the 12:30, and they waved me through. And I ended up sort of wandering around the State Department.
And this was for what? So why did you want to get in there?
This was for, because I wanted to see what it physically looked like for our art department, because we were going to build the State Department for In the Loop. And for that reason, I thought, well, I might as well take photos. So I was sort of taking these photos thinking, well,
soon something is going to happen.
Interesting, but it is also, I'm technically committing international espionage here.
Yes. So,
and then some big guy did turn up and go, excuse me. And I said, I was with my assistant, Sean. I said, we're here for the 12:30. And he went, well, it's just over there. And so we went into the 12:30, which was Condoleezza Rice's press briefing. It was her press.
You were right up close with Condoleezza.
Her press spokesman. It was a daily briefing. Very dull.
Very dull.
But I then told this story when In the Loop came out, and Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State then, and she ordered a full review of security at the State Department as a result. As a result, she wasn't killed and therefore stood as a Democrat candidate against Donald Trump and lost.
And lost.
So in effect, yes, I am responsible for Donald Trump.
There's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders just in this brief time.
No, I think about it.
You've just filmed your Netflix show. Is it in the can?
It's in the can.
So
it's
tell
all
me about
done.
It.
Yeah, I'm really nervous. I've never acted before. Like, it was so... I was in way over my head, but I had the best time. So I think it comes out in February or March.
So what's the premise?
Well, it's about... I play a version of myself, so... comedian called May, who's
a version of yourself.
Yeah.
Do you mean a photocopy?
Yeah, pretty much. Who's a recovering addict and gets into a relationship with a previously straight woman, and it's just a romantic comedy about addiction and love, and yeah, it's quite. It gets dark in places, but I think it's funny. It's got Lisa Kudrow playing my mom. That was insane. I know. I'm a huge, huge fan of The Comeback, this show that she did that was mostly, it seems improvised. Maybe it was scripted, but it's just an amazing show called The Comeback that she did after Friends. And obviously, I love Friends. But so, yeah, it was amazing.
So what did you learn from the actors around you? What was the big tip?
Well, I just kind of thought, I mean, you've acted. I thought...
Oh, that's a loose term. I kind of thought...
You just arrange your... I was like, how do I... So I'm doing a scene where I'm very sad. So how do I arrange my face to look sad? And what facial expression... I was obsessed with facial expressions. And then everyone was like, no, just feel sad and your face will do it. So that was eye-opening.
So you started... This is amazing. So you started with just the muscular contortion of the face.
Yeah.
That's how you act.
Yeah, totally. Because I was like...
This is brand new.
Well, definitely in my... it's not like a... I don't know. But then I found it... I ended up finding it. All my friends are actors, and so I was pretty always judgmental when they were like, "Oh, I'm so drained from doing this play. I'm just emotionally exhausted." And I was like, "Wow, really? From pretending to be sad for an hour, and now you're tired?" But actually, it was very intense.
The hours are long.
Long hours, and my character relapses in it, so I had to do a lot of like snorting fake coke and stuff, which I found really difficult and intense. So that was, yeah, intense, but it is funny, I promise. It sounds really bleak, but...
No, I mean, but I also think all great comedy has to have a counterpoint, otherwise it's relentless and sinister almost. It's like, what are you selling here? This is nothing like real life.
Yeah, it's eerie.
That is a big deal, though, for a recovering addict to recreate.
Yeah, I didn't really think that through when I wrote it.
That's horrible.
Yeah, I guess it's been so long but I think for most people who've had specifically like a coke problem, or I don't know, any drug maybe, but you imagine all the time what it would be like to relapse and what that would look like and how you'd feel. And so in a way it was cathartic to do that, and it felt awful. So that was
that's good.
Great, well, don't do that. But yeah, very strange.
Imagining this QI school for years and years and years, and I know exactly how it would work, and you should definitely be the head teacher.
I would love to be.
Because that's exactly, I mean, Plato, here I'm quoting everybody, but Plato said early education should be a form of play. That way you will be better able to discover the child's natural bent. And what I would do is, you know, I'd have the kids play for 2 years and watch them and say, oh, she's going to be a mathematician, or I'm a Dutchman, or and that guy there, he's an actor, and this person's a musician, and so on.
Mm.
And then you would only competitively examine, if at all, the children in their chosen field. So the people already engaged and loved the subject, they could do proper exams and everything else. They'd have to do all the other lessons, but all the other lessons would be fun. So if you were, let's say, a natural... linguist, you know, you'd learn probably several languages, but you wouldn't have to do maths in any sort of exam way. You go to maths, but they wouldn't make you do the things that I used to cry trying to do my times tables. They had to send me, my parents sent me to the Isle of Wight for 3 weeks with a fierce little old lady who banged them into me. You know, she just made me learn them until I knew them off by heart. So I'm more or less anumerate. But because of Q, I started getting interested in maths from the story point of view, you know.
Same with me, the philosophy of mathematics. Yeah.
Or that Leonard Euler was blind, for example, and, you know, or that Napoleon invented a mathematical theorem, and, you know, so that you learn the maths by accident, by inference, which is the whole idea of QI, is you're so interested, you don't even know you're learning. You're not being told, no, you've got that wrong. Do this, do that.
There is no wrong. But also I like the idea that, and this is evidenced in QI as well, and could be part of your QI school, that the teacher doesn't know everything.
No.
that old 1950s notion of the sort of the head, the strict head teacher who's a font of knowledge, and there's no margins outside of what they know is doesn't exist in your world, because it's like if a kid comes to you and says something interesting, you take it on and go, I love that. And I'm going to read up about it.
It's so true. Somebody said, I forget who it was, the mark of a good teacher is someone who can elicit from the class a question that they themselves cannot answer. And that's when you know people are engaged, because they're asking why.
There's so much of what you do that's about absorbing criticism, and I wonder how much of that is just externalizing what's inside. I mean, you will publish, you know, your latest book, March the Lemmings. It's all about, you've included the under the line stuff that you've got from the columns.
Yeah.
And there's a glee.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that part of absorbing the criticism is that when obviously with stand-up, if you're doing it under your own name, you are yourself. You're not a pub landlord or an urban warrior or whatever, you are yourself, but you have to, you know, exaggerate bits of yourself. And I think that lots of different people helped me to work out who the stand-up was. When I first lived in London, 89, 90, I'd come in from my temp job complaining about things, and the people who I lived with at the time, principally Richard Herring, who I ended up doing the double act with, would say, that just sounds like material, your actual opinion of your description of your day. You've had such an extreme, unself-aware response to that. It sounds like material. So kind of people have helped you realise what a theatre person would say is, what's your clown, you know?
Yeah.
And then subsequently, when the internet was invented, I didn't really realise what was going on the internet for about 10 years. And then when I think the first series of Comedy Vehicle was on, I realised there were all these forums of people.
Mm.
This is about 2007, 2008, yes. Commenting on it, and I started looking at them, and loads of the things they hated about it were sort of what I was trying to do. You know, they'd go, it's this smug, detached person trying to build up, make everyone think they're clever and they're not. And I thought, well, yeah, that's sort of what he is, right? So I looked at all those criticisms, and between the first and second series of Comedy Vehicle, the criticisms really strengthened it, because I became more like the things that people didn't like.
But it's interesting, you said that's what he is. And that's,
yeah, I know.
You've used
I know, I do it all the time. Yeah,
can you work out what? I mean, I'm not asking you for percentages, but yeah. I mean, presumably it's just it. Sometimes it's very you, and sometimes it's a posture, I guess.
Yeah, it is. I mean, so and also sometimes I'm inside my head, and he's going on, and I'm sort of thinking, what if he said this now? It'd be absolutely awful. And then he'll say it, and I'll go, oh, now I've got to try and get out of that. And he's really, he's put me in a really difficult position. So it's sort of like you can force, you know. And I do again, it's like two things in a. You know,
yeah.
Look, I think anyone who writes anything's got to be able to split their brain in some way like that. You know, to sort of, you have the thing that's doing it and the thing that's commenting on it.
But not many people are brave enough to go, everyone can think of the worst thing in the world, but not many people will let it escape their mouth.
Well, that's one of the things that's in those American script writing handbooks, isn't it? You know, put your character in the most incredible jeopardy and then try and work back from it. But yeah, it's sort of what position can you put yourself in, you know? And also in every show I try and do something that I'm not very good at, whether it's trying to sing a song or do something.
I love that though. That's the vulnerability bit underneath the bluster. But maybe he says something awful and Stu Lee has to work out how he feels about that.
Yeah, I know. Although again, you must have that. I mean, you have to go into, for a bake-off or something, you have to step up into a sort of, what's interesting about that is the pair of you are doing a TV presenter job, but there's still you're still the double act in it.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's two things happening there, aren't there? You have to deliver televisual information.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, there's a suggestion that the two people that have been given this job have some historic bickering relationship, which isn't what happens with people who are presenting Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah,
or something,
no,
is it?
They're absolutely. Not,
which is clearly what people, again, when they tried to, I expect you've signed a non-disclosure agreement.
No, I can say anything.
When they tried to didn't people typically of telling people understand that there was some other thing going on there which was bigger than the sum of its parts, you know. So when you move it over, you can't just recreate that relationship with some other people because it's an organic thing. It's not going to be the same. You know?
I suspect what our counterpoint was is that we were in together. We feel like subversive children. We feel like the faces may have withered, but inside there's just this caprice.
Okay, you
and
get
naughtiness.
This. You can't believe you've been allowed to do that sort of thing. So what would they do? They'd have fun with it, wouldn't they?
And then suddenly you're in this. It didn't start that way, but suddenly you become this culture, part of this culturally safe, enshrined thing. Yeah. And yet inside you're delinquent children watching people watching ovens.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of gramophone. Now, the economic argument within this is it's, and in so many of the things you discussed, there's an element of luck and geographical happenstance that happens in a lot of these success stories. So the thing I loved about that, and that what's great about this book is it's chock full of these brilliant, as you say, personal examples, is the earlier phonograph. And I had no idea that you could only make a certain number of copies, two or three or something.
Mind-blowing. It's like most people won't remember this, but when I was really young, I used to write stories on a typewriter, my mum's old typewriter, with carbon paper.
Yeah.
And carbon paper, people, CC, that stands for carbon copy. So there's this bit of paper you'd put underneath your first type sheet, and you could do it twice. And you type really hard, and the carbon punches through one or two sheets, and it makes, so you can type two copies or three copies at a time. Bewilderingly archaic technology. But that's kind of how the phonograph was. The original Edison phonograph was, you can sing, and we will live transcribe it onto wax cylinders, and we can do three, maybe four. And if you want more than four copies, you've got to sing it again.
So this is the African-American singer George W. Johnson in 1890, who basically has to sing an entire day and sings himself hoarse just to maybe pump out 200 records.
Yeah, and I think he did it day after day. It was incredible. The same song everyone wanted to hear. And it's not quite as impossible as it sounds, because most of those records would then go into jukeboxes. So people would be paying money to, they'd be in some public space. You'd pay to listen to a recording of the song. If you wanted to listen to a recording of the song, you'd go away, and then someone else comes in and they pay to listen to a recording of the song. So you were reaching more people than you might think, but still, I mean, it's incredibly primitive. So it wasn't really a duplication technology in the way that the flat LP was, the vinyl album, which came later. And then at which point you can make as many copies as you like, and that changes things.
So there's a sense that your global domination, your ability to disseminate your creative genius is entirely limited to not only what technology's around at the time, but where you happen to be geographically and what access you have. And where does streaming fit into that?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, the point of the whole gramophone story is to make us think about how technology interacts with people's skill to produce their economic return. So people get paid for being good at something, but how much they get paid completely depends on the technology. So what we're doing now, recording a podcast, would have been totally impossible 20 years ago. You'd have to distribute it by cassette, which, I mean, I think there was some person who did that and he tried to get a patent on it. But so the rewards to the same activity, the same level of skill as a performer, vary wildly depending on the technology. And so I was trying to get people to think about that. It's not just the gramophone. It's not just streaming. It's everywhere. So whatever we do, whether we're journalists or taxi drivers or an investment banker, the returns that you're paid to your skill depend on the technology interacting with that skill. So what the gramophone did is made it possible for the top people to basically earn almost unlimited returns. You could reach as many people as you like. And suddenly, no one's interested in the 10th best opera singer in the world. Who cares? Whereas previously, the 10th best opera singer in the world could earn a good living. Now it's all, I just want the top one or two. Now, streaming to some extent reverses that, because it just takes away the reward from being recorded. And it puts it back towards live performance, which is what David Bowie told us, I think, 20 years ago, 15 years ago.
Anything that David Bowie has ever said is, for me, the immediate stuff of legend.
So he said it's going to be like water or electricity. You just turn on the tap and it comes out. Well,
it was incredibly prescient, actually, for him to come really out was. With that. You know,
it really was. And he said musicians need to get used to touring because that's where the scarcity will be. The economics of touring are a bit different than they used to be because you have stadium rock and amplification and all this. But yeah.
And the way that the album now, the relationship between the album and the tour has changed, as you say.
Yeah, the tour used to be about selling the album. Yeah. Now the album's about selling the tour.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, in my business as a writer, book festivals haven't quite figured this one out yet, and I'm not sure authors have quite figured this one out. So you used to be, you appear at a book festival in order to sell copies of your book. And now there's this realization, well, hang on, maybe the book is the loss leader for giving a talk. You're actually paid to give a talk about the book. The book itself, you kind of give away almost for free. And we're in this weird space in the market for writing and the market for authors and this book festival boom as to who should actually be benefiting when an author gives a talk. Is this something the author should give away for free, or should the author be giving away the books and selling the talk instead?
Let's go to Bake Off. Let's go to the elephant in the room. I mean, we've talked about it lots to third parties when we've been interviewed, but we haven't really sort of talked about it lots between the four of us. But we just had no idea, did we? We had no idea of.
No,
what
we
it was
had
to be
no idea, and the great thing about the Bake Off, it started in such a little way, a humble way, and I didn't know you two. I thought you were extraordinary, always mucking about.
How dare
and also
you?
Given a script on these little cards and nothing came out that was on the card.
No, never.
And it was always so funny and so good. And I was just in awe. I never knew what was coming next. And also, as time went on, I realised that both of you knew an awful lot about food. And I didn't imagine that you would, and you did. And, you know, you very cleverly didn't get involved with the technical side, but you knew it, and I could see that. I better say the right thing, because she knows if I don't.
No, you're the boss.
No, but yeah, but actually, it was so well, I mean, well chosen, because you had this great bond with Melly because you'd been at Cambridge with her and you'd done all sorts of things. I didn't know Paul, but we got on. I respected him. I respected his bread and his baking because I really was absolutely no good at making bread because I'd never done it. And in books, I hadn't done it very much. I had been off to have baking lessons before I had put recipes in books because I didn't know. So I was delighted to have Paul and all his knowledge. And that's why I think it was a sort of team.
And it clicked because we just laughed all the time. I mean, they're long, long, boring days, let's face it. But we just laughed. And I suppose we had your version of your mum's bridge. We had whist every afternoon, didn't we? Play a bit of whist.
What was that game that we played latterly? Cucumbers or whatever it
was. That was whist, but with cucumber cards. Do you
remember?
That's
right. Gorgeous.
You never quite... I mean, yes, there was a lot of... Were they your cards?
They were Mel's cards.
They had spiders.
That was a good game. And the other one we did towns. And the one... And you had to use... If you said a Liverpool... You had to do another town in England, beginning with L. And our one aim was to drop Paul in it and try and find things with Z at the end.
Well, let's play a little mini version of it now. So you basically have to start your town with the last letter, don't you, of the town that came before. Go on, then.
Bath.
Ham.
Monmouth.
Huntingdon.
Harrow. Anyway.
No, it's an N. You need to do an N.
Oh, sorry. Oh, and Nantwich.
This is how it always
yes,
went.
Yes. Anyway,
we'd do this for 2 hours, and then Paul would start making up towns.
Yeah, and also, all the time we were doing it, he would be on his phone.
Yes.
Not talking, but pressing buttons and so
on. Cheating, essentially, we call it.
Yes, that's right. If not, he would lean over and watch a motoring thing on the telly.
Oh, God, he's a hate. I won't miss that, much as I miss lots of it. We used to all sit in the green room together with all our lovely makeup friends and, you know, the runners, the sort of engines of the team. And Paul would just sit in the middle with his tight jeans on, press go on the, you know, the telly, and then there'd be the roar of Formula One. Oh, it used to drive us nuts, didn't it?
When the pillars have been restored and the churches there are no more, when the fountains all cease to flow, I'll be there if you want me to. When the marble has turned to clay and the people have all turned grey, and the Romans don't walk so slow, I'll be there if you want me to. I'll be there if you want me to.